Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and we're going to be talking about plantar fasciitis to start the program, at least. If you've had it, you know how painful it can be. We'll take a look at treatments today with our regular physical therapy guests, Jill Tine-Nissenbaum. Jill, good to have you back.
It's great to be here, as always.
And Lori Tine-Brody. Lori, good to see you as well.
It is great to be here.
Jill is an associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at the UW-Madison. Lori, a physical therapist, athletic trainer at the UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. So we'll talk with them about plantar fasciitis treatments, and certainly we'll deal with other kinds of aches and pains and sprains and strains along the way. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Well, we get plantar fasciitis, I think, on every show you've ever done, Jill.
I think you're right. I think we usually get at least one phone call about how to manage it, because it's such a chronic condition and people have it for so long, and it is very difficult to manage.
And what causes it?
Well, it's usually a gradual, insidious onset of overuse where the structures on the bottom of our foot actually get somewhat stretched out and irritated. Our plantar fascia attaches into our calcaneus, our heel bone, and without adequate support, when we take a step, every time we take a step, it kind of tugs or pulls on it and irritates that connective tissue. It hurts a lot.
It does hurt a lot. And mechanically, you know, what happens is this fascia is at the end by your toes spreads out over the bottom of your foot to the base of each of those toes, but then it comes back to a single point on your heel, and so all that force is directed at one spot. And some people will say, well, I have a heel spur, so if I just get rid of that heel spur, won't my pain go away? And it's important to understand that the bony spur you see is really a symptom of the problem. It's a symptom of that constant tugging that's happening on the calcaneus bone that Jill described. So it is not the cause of the problem, but it's a sign that you have chronic tugging or stretching there, and that foot needs to be supported.
Yeah, you know, over time I've heard you talk about a variety of treatments.
Right.
What treatments are out there and which ones work the best?
That's a great question. So there was a really nice clinical practice guideline, which is somebody who summarizes all the information that we have out there on a specific thing. And the clinical practice guideline for heel pain, which came out a few years ago, really found very good quality evidence for treatments such as manual therapy, when physical therapists actually do joint mobilizations or movements of the joint, stretching, taping, wearing an orthotic, and then, of course, Lori and my personal favorite, the dreaded night splint, all came back as showing really strong evidence that these interventions or these treatments are actually helpful in managing a patient's plantar fasciitis. One of the things that came back as somewhat questionable was the use of therapeutic ultrasound.
Yeah, what's the research on that?
So there was a very nice study that just came out this month in the Journal of Orthopedic and Sports Physical Therapy, and it's a very nice randomized controlled trial, and the patients were actually blinded to the intervention, and they took half of the group, and they actually performed therapeutic ultrasound on them. The other group just got a sham ultrasound, so the ultrasound was in essence ineffective. And what they found is over time both groups got better, but there was no difference between the group that got the therapeutic ultrasound and the group that got the sham or the fake treatment.
So why the heck do it then?
We're not. That's exactly right. So it's a treatment that's shown to be ineffective.
Of note, both groups had stretching exercises.
Correct.
So they didn't just get better over time, but they got better probably because of the stretching that both groups did.
Correct.
Well, we have a number of callers who have questions for you, and guess what? There's a plantar fasciitis question coming right up from John in Madison. Hi, John.
Hi, guys. I have an unusual twist on the idea of therapy. I was wondering if there's any connection or there's any empirical evidence for a connection between diet or what you eat and plantar fasciitis. And the reason I ask that is because I've been experimenting with intermittent fasting. And when the body is in a fasting state, It engages in autophagy, which is repair and cellular cleanup. There's also evidence that fasting reduces inflammation levels in the body, and I've seen anecdotal evidence that fasting reduces plantar fasciitis, and I'm just wondering if there's any scientific interest or any evidence of this, and I'll just hang up and listen to your answer.
All right, John, thank you.
Well, what a fabulous question. So, to the best of my knowledge, that question has not been studied. So, to speak to your point about fasting and diet and inflammation, absolutely there is a connection between what you eat and inflammation. In the world of epigenetics, turning genes off, turning genes on, and the world of nutrition, where they discuss the benefits of different types of intermittent fasting. And there are a number of different models of intermittent fasting out there, whether it's for a day or a couple days or a series of number of hours. It has to be specific to the individual and whatever other comorbidities they might have. But there is strong evidence to support the benefits of intermittent fasting, and it would follow logically that it could certainly have an impact on inflammation. So I thank you for bringing that question up.
Right.
One of the questions, and maybe Jill wants to talk about this, it's called plantar fasciitis, but is it an osis or is
Correct.
It an itis? Is there really an inflammation
right.
present? And it isn't a yes or no question. There may be a component of itis and osis, which is degeneration of the fascia.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. We're starting to get away from the terms that end in itis. So plantar fasciitis, as many people who have it will tell you, it lasts well beyond the acute inflammatory process. Some people have it for up to a year. And that inflammation isn't probably going on that whole time. Interestingly, in the shoulder, we used to call it adhesive capsulitis. And now people are really going away from that term, and we're truly just calling it frozen shoulder because we're getting away from that itis.
Itis business.
Yep. Yep.
Interesting. Well, let's take a call from Tom in Frog Point. Hi, Tom.
Hi to you, Larry, and to Jill and Lori. I have a question about plantar fasciitis, and I never was diagnosed, but I have had Lyme disease and 5 cases of it.
Oh, geez.
And so a lot of antibiotics, mm-hmm. but I was having a lot of trouble with my heel, particularly at night, not so much maybe walking or other activities, except if I did it maybe a little more unusually active. But anyway, I started using a pillow first under my knees, and then I switched to a full-length pillow going from my upper leg all the way down to my heel, and it just gave me great relief during the night. Now, my question is, does that cut off circulation? And I've had a lot of cramps lately, and I don't know if it's from the Lyme disease or what.
Yeah.
So that's a great question. So it sounds to me like if Tom's using a pillow that doesn't cause any excessive knee flexion or kinks, and it's more like a slope
Straight
or gradual incline, that actually is probably helping with edema or swelling and kind of bringing things back to his heart. So I would not think that if he doesn't have any bend in his knee or anything like that, could be causing the cramps.
Yeah. And honestly, from the description of your symptoms, I don't think it's really plantar fasciitis.
I don't either.
Plantar fasciitis typically does not bother you at night, but it hurts first thing in the morning when you get out of bed. So my guess is whatever pain you're having in your foot is either related to your Lyme's, could also be coming from your back, because as you change the position of your leg, it changes your position relative to your pelvis and your back as well, and may have improved alignment there. It could have been some sciatic symptoms. So that, along with your cramping, could point to some spinal stenosis. So you might think about getting that checked out and have someone take a look at your back.
Tom, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And speaking of
stenosis,
let's go to Faye in Milwaukee. Hi, Faye.
Oh, hello. I'm going to ask a question about stenosis in my lower spine. And I had sciatic pain 4 years. 10 years ago, I did have surgery where they fuse some of those vertebrae in the lumbar area.
Okay.
And one of the symptoms was I had like tingling in my right toe. So that went away after the surgery. So it's 10 years, and now I'm starting to feel that a little bit again. And thinking that maybe I have possibly more compression. But if I take my knee and pull it over my body and stretch that, it does relieve it.
Mm-hmm.
So my question to you is, the thought of surgery is like, oh,
all right,
I don't want to do that again,
right,
even though it was very successful. Can this be managed through physical therapy? I mean, the right stretches, really, I mean, ultimately forever. Can
sure.
this be managed?
Absolutely. So physical therapists see patients with stenosis very frequently. So we can't actually change the narrowing that's going on either in your foramen or in the vertebral canal, but we can teach you how to position yourself as well as give you appropriate stretches and appropriate places to exercise, such as the pool, so you can actually maintain your joint mobility and maintain your adequate strength and conditioning.
Yeah, and just like Tom, the caller before you, he found when he positioned himself at night a certain way, it helped with his leg pain. And so that stretch that you're doing, what you're probably doing is opening up your foramen a little bit in your low back with that position, and it takes the pressure off the nerve root. My guess is 10 years post-fusion, you're starting to get failure at the level
above or below
your fusion, which is classically what happens. So getting back in to see a physical therapist and reviewing the exercises that you need to do to take the stress off of those levels above and below your fusion is really important. Making sure that you have sufficient mobility above and below your fusion, mobility in your hip and pelvis so that you're not overloading your back. Those are all strategies that we use to help preserve your back post-fusion.
Good luck. Thank you, Faye, for calling. Carlene in Brooklyn will give you a chance. Hi, Carlene.
Hi there. I'm actually calling about my husband. He was diagnosed a while back with plantar fasciitis and did, stretches, the splint, orthotics, everything, and thin comfort shoes actually seemed to be the thing that did the trick for him because he couldn't be off his feet. But the thing that's happening now is that his toes and his right foot seem to be curling up and will not flatten very easily. And really, they cramp. They hurt when he tries to flatten them. We massage them and stretch them, but nothing seems to be working for flattening those toes. I'm wondering if it's connected to the plantar fasciitis or if there's anything that you can recommend that might be helpful.
And that's in the foot that had the plantar fasciitis in it, Carlene?
Yes.
And is it all his toes? Or
it's,
just...
It's the three middle ones in particular and somewhat his big toe.
Okay. So is he's wearing these orthotics. Has it happened since he got his orthotics? I mean, what's the relationship time-wise? So he had the plantar fasciitis, he got the orthotics. How soon did he start getting the cramping in his toes?
The cramping in his toes has been since the plantar fasciitis pain has subsided. So it was really the thin comfort shoes that seemed to do the trick on the plantar fasciitis. That was... The other things weren't really touching it. And
So would it have made...
Over the last year, his toes have become curled up and painful.
Okay, so he isn't doing an orthotic. He's not doing the night splint. He's just changed his shoe wear.
Mostly, yes.
Okay. And so how long after he changed his shoes did he start getting the cramping?
Well, it's been over the last year that mostly at night when he's not...
Okay.
Wearing shoes.
Okay. He needs to have this evaluated. So there are multiple areas where that could be causing the cramping. It could be coming from his back. He could have some mechanical issues in his foot related to the shoes that he's now wearing.
Right, that's what I'm wondering, so, if there's a little bit of a nerve impingement or something in the shoes since he's been changed his shoe wear.
That's what I was trying to figure out, if the shoes were the culprit, that it fixed his plantar fasciitis, but it changed the mechanics at his foot and ankle to cause that. Or if he's walking differently and he's overloading something else farther up the kinetic chain. But there's nothing that clearly jumps out at either of us as being the culprit. So I think he needs to have someone take a look at this and assess it and really figure out where the source of the symptoms is.
And I heard you say that he has to walk for work. So make sure that when he sees someone, and you can certainly start with seeing a physical therapist, that he brings those shoes with him and perhaps a different pair of shoes, and kind of see what he looks like walking in each pair of shoes to see if there is a dramatic change or something that's somehow loading his foot differently.
Yeah, makes good sense. Carlene, thank you so much. Good luck. Appreciate your call. Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, physical therapists at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, our guests today. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Dave Potratz, our engineer, Jill Nadeau, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. We're taking a look at all sorts of physical therapy issues. We've zeroed in a little on plantar fasciitis, but other issues have come up as well. With our two guests, Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us today. We're going to go right back to the phones and take another call. Diane in Green Bay, thanks for waiting. Appreciate your call. Diane, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead. What's your question?
It's not a question. It's just a statement. I had plantar fasciitis twice, and my podiatrist told me that when I get out of bed, I should stand by my bed and count to 120 before I take that first step. Certainly not a cure, but it did help. Is this true, or was this just my happy thinking?
I think there's definitely some science to it. So typically when we sleep at night, especially if you're not in that night splint, your plantar fascia is in a shortened position. And those first few steps in the morning where we immediately stretch our plantar fascia can be very painful. So to stand and kind of slowly let that tissue kind of remodel and stretch back out very slowly before we take those first few steps makes good sense. We tell patients if they hit their snooze that that's when they should do some stretching of their plantar fascia while they're in bed. So that idea of not going from an immediately shortened position to a sudden, rapid, quick load in your plantar fascia makes good sense.
Yeah, if you just bring your ankle up and down and pull your toes up or back a little bit, just sort of up and down, some ankle pumps, some toe wiggling to increase the circulation and warm up that tissue on the bottom of your foot will certainly help, as well as just standing. Mm-hmm. But if you have to go to the bathroom, really? I don't know that I could count to 120.
There you go.
You.
Here I am wiggling my toes and pulling my foot back as you're giving me the instructions. Yeah.
Thanks,
here.
Diane, for that good advice.
Appreciate it. Well, Connie in New Lisbon just had an appointment this morning, I think.
Yeah, for her plantar fasciitis.
Oh. Hi, Connie.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Yeah, it's very timely. I saw a doctor a month ago because it got so bad I could barely walk, and he gave me a cortisone shot in my heel, which helped a little, but didn't quite resolve the problem, and it didn't quite fit, so he sent me to physical therapy. I went this morning. The therapist found a lot of tenderness and swelling in my Achilles and said I probably have tendonitis in my Achilles in addition to the plantar fasciitis. So I'm wondering, did one cause the other, and is it going to complicate my recovery?
That's an excellent question. So the Achilles tendon attaches on the backside of the calcaneus, and your plantar fascia actually attaches on the plantar, the bottom aspect of the calcaneus. And some people think that those two are very intimately connected and almost play tug of war on that heel bone. So indeed, Connie, there is a relationship there. And which one came first, it's difficult to say. Although in your case, it sounds like it's the plantar fasciitis. If it altered the way you walked, which it sounds like it did, because you had mentioned that you had it was so painful for you to walk, just changing your gait pattern may have been enough to irritate your Achilles tendon. Interestingly, Achilles tendon stretching or stretching of the Achilles is in our list of ways to manage plantar fasciitis. Interestingly, about 80% of people with plantar fasciitis will get better if you just give them Achilles stretching.
Yeah, and you'll have to work with your physical therapist on your Achilles tendonitis. If you have a lot of swelling, crepitus, if you have nodules, you may need to be in a boot for a while. And then if things calm down and you start to feel better, then you really have to do the therapy so that these things don't come back. It doesn't mean just because you feel better, then everything is cured and you can be on your way. So you really should talk with your physical therapist and work closely with that person as well as your physician to see if you need to be in a boot for a while.
And interestingly, talked about tendonitis and tendinosis. It really sounds like Connie truly has that Achilles tendonitis because she has that swelling, that crepitus. That makes us really think it's more in that acute phase. So immobilizing her for a little bit, like Lori said, in a boot would be a good strategy.
Yeah. Good luck.
Let us know how you do, Connie.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. On to Phil in Kingston. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Larry. Thanks, sir, and everyone for taking my call. I just got diagnosed with plantar fasciitis and going through a lot of pain. Something that complicated is I also have peripheral neuropathy from diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like a double whammy.
It is a double whammy.
So one of my good friends, she's an RT. She's on her feet for 12 hours a day in a hospital. So she's getting shots. And then a good friend, her sister, she had laser therapy years ago. And it was just disappeared after that, after the laser therapy. It was amazing. It was new therapy at the time. So I'm just told to do stretches right now, and my doctor says it could be weeks or even months before I see relief. So with the peripheral neuropathy in my foot and so forth, what things should I be doing besides the stretching, since it seems like that complicates it? And it's kind of confusing with the pain because I'm getting pain from both.
Right. So it definitely is complicated.
Yeah. So have you been sent to physical therapy?
No, I haven't. I was just told to do stretching exercises, you know, for several times
right.
a day.
Right. I would request some physical therapy so you can get some additional intervention. Some of the things Jill discussed at the top of the show, some manual therapy could be helpful for you. Looking at your foot mechanics to see if an orthotic would help you. Discussion of a night splint as a possibility to help speed things along for you.
Right. And especially with your neuropathy, it would be very, very important that you get a very specific, customized stretching and strengthening program because you do have a substantial comorbidity. So I definitely think seeing someone and very much personalizing your program would be a good strategy. The stretches you mentioned may be appropriate, but there may be other things that a physical therapist would add in addition to that that will help expedite the process.
And the other piece of it is, stretching is not all the same. Stretching
right.
is not stretching is not stretching. There's an issue of dosage,
right?
Frequency, intensity, duration, what structures you're stretching. If your foot is in the right position to actually stretch the tissues that you're wanting to stretch, for example, when we see people and we're trying to stretch their Achilles, for example, if they have significant pronation or they're flat-footed, they try to stretch and they don't neutralize their heel, they will be stretching the wrong structures. They'll be stretching things that should not be stretched, and the Achilles will not be stretched. So getting some good advice and instruction on how to stretch and making sure the dosage is appropriate for you makes sense as well.
Mm-hmm. Good luck. Thank you, Phil, for calling. And Dan in Hartford, it's your turn. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Well, I'm a person who is very active, and I'm wondering with the upcoming cross-country skiing season coming in, and I tend to also ignore my plantar fasciitis. Mm. I do stretch slightly, but not religiously enough. Is that just aggravating things by doing just active things, like by cross-country skiing, or is that something that actually ends up helping the stretch?
So that's a great question. So you had mentioned it's cross-country skiing. So do you classic or skate ski?
A classic.
You classic. Okay, so that's actually a lot of kind of stretching on your plantar fascia because you roll up onto your toes. And so that's a good deal of stretching of your plantar fascia. So you would be someone that if you were my patient, I would encourage you to be extraordinarily compliant instead of doing some occasional things. I would want you in really tip-top shape before the snow flies, and apparently it already has. Mm-hmm. But I would do lots of things proactively, like get you on a really good stretching program, perhaps put you in a night splint. So seeing a physical therapist, I think, would be a really good strategy for you because you will need to figure out how much is too much for you from a cross-country skiing perspective.
Right. And so that goes back to that same issue of dosage.
Right.
So you can think about your physical therapy rehabilitation in a dosage of a certain number of stretches, strengthening, repetitions, time, etc. But the same is true for your skiing. Mm-hmm. So you think of that as kind of part of your rehabilitation, which I think was the genesis of your question at the beginning. Can skiing be rehabilitation? And it certainly can be if you dose it correctly. You don't want to overload it, just like you wouldn't say, oh, I think I'll take up running. I'm going to go run a marathon. Okay, so the same thing for your foot. The dosage has to be within the tissue tolerance. Does that make sense?
It does. And with doing the stretching at home, and you can look them up online.
Right.
There's some good ones and some bad ones. How long should it be before I start to see some kind of results from all of that stretching?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, remember that stretching is only one piece of this very large puzzle. So the first question is, why do you have it in the first place? Is there something about the mechanics of your foot that needs correction? Do you need an orthotic? Do you have a leg length difference? Do you have weakness farther up the kinetic chain? Do you have a stiff foot? So, you know, how do you spend your day? Are you standing all day? You know, so those are the other factors that come into play here. So stretching alone will not solve it if there's some underlying cause for your plantar fasciitis that hasn't been addressed.
There you go. Thank you, Dan, for calling. Appreciate it. Speaking of causes, Tim in Crystal Lake, Illinois has a question.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm curious about if they can address the cause of plantar fasciitis. I have had a sudden onset, so I'm wondering if a fall or trauma could bring this on, and then also how to accurately get a good diagnosis.
Sure. So most people have a gradual insidious onset with their plantar pain. It's from, just like Lori talked about with dosage, it's doing too much too soon too quickly. Perhaps it's a change in shoe wear, doing the same activity but in a different pair of shoes. For me personally, my plantar fasciitis was due to my snow boots, and my snow boots were not very well, weren't very supportive, and we had a very snowy winter, and that was the cause of mine. You can also have traumatic plantar fasciitis where you actually can partially tear or pull on the plantar fascia due to a specific mechanism of injury, whether it's a one-time huge jump or leap or a fall, as you mentioned. So it can be either a gradual onset or you can have an acute mechanism of injury.
In terms of diagnosis, we look at clinical history as a big piece of it. So the classic symptomology for this is it hurts first thing out of bed in the morning. That is the classic hallmark symptom of this for the reasons that Jill mentioned earlier. When you sleep, your toes are pointed, your plantar fascia becomes shortened, and then when you step down on it with all of your weight and stretch it suddenly, it hurts like mad. So pain first thing in the morning, or pain after you've been sitting for some period of time, whether you work at a desk or you're at a movie and you get up and you take those first couple steps and it really hurts. It hurts on the under surface of your foot, on the heel, just slightly to the inside, and you can put your finger right on a spot that hurts.
Some people say it feels like they're walking on a marble.
Yeah.
There's a marble under their heel.
Yeah.
Yeah. So those would be the way we make the diagnosis. There's not any other specific test for that.
There we go. Thanks, Tim. Appreciate it. And Amy in Rice Lake, your turn. Hi, Amy.
Hi. Say, I've got kind of a crazy question. I have had an unusual tingling, worms crawling under my skin.
Worms crawling under your skin. That's a good one.
On the bottom of my feet, I would say from mostly in the arch to the heel area. It bothers me mostly at night or when my feet are hot, and it wakes me up. So I might get up and put an ice pack on my feet, and I can get back to sleep, but I've been to a podiatrist. I've been to a neurologist. Nobody can seem to pinpoint what may be causing it. I had it constantly for about, I would say, 2 months, and then suddenly it cleared up for about 6 weeks. I was thinking maybe it had something to do with stress, but now it's back again, and I'm in a pretty calm time in my life.
Okay.
I'm not feeling any stress, and I'm just wondering if you had ever heard of anything like that.
So, interestingly, there is a branch off your tibial nerve. It's called your medial plantar nerve that runs along your arch, kind of on the inside of your foot, basically from your heel all the way to your toes. Something we call tarsal tunnel syndrome. And that nerve can become entrapped under soft tissue or if your foot is loaded abnormally. Have you seen a physical therapist?
No.
I would encourage you to see a physical therapist because it sounds to me like you have what we call tarsal tunnel syndrome, which is an entrapment of this nerve, this branch of your tibial nerve. And why it is entrapped or where it is entrapped would require a physical therapist evaluation, but they could teach you how to mobilize it and then also fix any biomechanics that you have in your feet.
It is the foot correlation of carpal tunnel syndrome in your wrist.
There
so
we
the
go.
Same thing happens at your foot.
And thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Cynthia emailed to ask what is the best shoe choice for a woman with plantar fasciitis.
Oh. The one that's comfortable is typically what we say. It's interesting, just if we can extrapolate the research we have looking at running shoes, and is there a foot type that should match a certain shoe type? And the answer is actually no. You should really go what's comfortable for you that doesn't require break-in period.
Right. Yeah. You know, I have people who say, you know, shoe X, these are the only shoes that are comfortable for me. And I look at them and I think mechanically, it makes absolutely no sense whatsoever.
Right.
But it, you know.
But it works.
But correct. It works. Exactly. So that's our advice. We can give you all kinds of advice in terms of heel counters and rigid counters and controlling excessive pronation and heel cups and on and on and on and on. But really at the end of the day, it's what you can wear that doesn't hurt your heel.
Right.
And let's go from the shoes to the socks. Jolie from Mozanie called to ask, how are compression socks helpful to leg health, or are they?
So compression socks or recovery socks are what we call those, and they have just a very low grade compression, and it's usually about 15 millimeters of mercury, although you can get more. And the theory behind them is if you wear them post exercise, they help kind of encourage blood flow or encourage return to the heart.
I don't think there's a tremendous amount of research. I think they've looked at this, and I don't have anything, a paper off the top of my head, but I remember just reading about this where subjectively people after races, there was no difference between those who wore compression socks and those who didn't. But I think I would put it in the same category as the shoes.
Right.
If you feel like you recover better and your legs feel better the next day after you've worn these for, you know, racing or walking or running or whatever your activity is, again, it's an individual choice. There may be people who have just dynamite circulation in their legs and everything moves through there and they clear away waste products beautifully like the best, you know, trash man around. And then you have other people where things are a little bit sluggish and maybe you get a little bit of accumulation of fluid down there and your legs feel a little heavy the next day. So a little bit of compression to help facilitate that circulation can certainly help.
I will tell you a group anecdotally who I know who I work with that feels they are the best thing since sliced bread. And those are our surgeons who have to stand still in OR for a prolonged period of time and have to statically stand, and they would end up with a lot of swelling in their ankles at the end of the day just because they couldn't promote good circulation. And on OR days when they have to just statically stand for a long period of time, they find that wearing these compression socks, some of them actually wear them up onto their thighs, is very helpful.
You could certainly extrapolate that to a number of different professions.
Exactly, 100%.
I was just thinking of the gal that at the grocery store.
Right. Oh, right. Exactly. Right. Yeah. That's a classic example. The checkout people.
Well, so that was a great question that got posed. So thank
you. There
you
go.
Let's take a call from Sarah in Deerfield. Hi, Sarah.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a comment about Achilles tendonitis. I had it in both ankles, not right away, but they developed over the course of about a year and a half. And it failed physical therapy and boot stabilization. I had actually platelet-rich plasma injections in each Achilles tendon about a month apart and had amazing results from that. They were quite thick and knobby and stiff and, you know, caused quite a bit of pain. But I never had plantar fasciitis associated with it. It was all Achilles tendon pain. I am subsequently having further foot problems, and, of course, don't really know, you know, if that led to this. But I'm wondering if there's any further research on platelet-rich plasma injections for things other than Achilles tendonitis, if you guys know anything about that for plantar fasciitis, if that is at all helpful, if there's a correlation with that.
That's a great question. So we have looked at research regarding platelet-rich plasma for multiple tendinosis or tendinopathies. And what platelet-rich plasma is they take blood, your own blood, and they centrifuge it, and they use the plasma-rich part of it, and they inject that into the area of tendinosis or tendinopathy, and it almost kind of creates, for lack of better terms, little Pac-Mans that go in and they eat away the bad materials and helps you kind of promote the healing process to lay down new structures. So interestingly enough, it has not been proven to be successful in the treatment of plantar fasciitis. It's been equivocal, and part of it probably has to do with the blood supply to the plantar fascia. So when we talk about Achilles tendon, that's connected to a muscle that's got good blood supply. Same thing when we talk about treating tennis elbow. So the plantar fasciitis seems to be a bit of an outlier. And so far, there hasn't been any studies regarding platelet-rich plasma showing that to be highly effective in the treatment of plantar fasciitis.
There you go. Thank you, Sarah, for calling. Appreciate your call. Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, our guest today. Lori, a physical therapist, athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Jill, an associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program here at UW-Madison. Call in at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at plantar fasciitis and all other kinds of aches and pains and sprains and strains with our two guests today. I'm Larry Mueller, by the way. My guests, Lori Tyne Brody, Jill Tyne Nissenbaum from the University of Wisconsin, physical therapy program. Great to have them along. All our lines are filled. Let's go to Karen in Milwaukee next. Karen, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
First, I just wanted to say about I did have plantar fasciitis. I had a $300 insert that I tried to wear for 6 months, got rid of that, got a $10 insert and did some exercises. It was gone in like a week or two. So, but the reason why I'm calling is I was wearing really bad shoes for a long period of time. I somehow hurt my tendon or ligament on the inside of my foot going around my ankle. That's where the pain is. I'm just starting to see a PT. But I'm doing some really, really basic, barely any kind of weight on it exercises. I was questioning about the most time that I get the pain is at night when I'm laying in bed and there's no like support on it or whatever. I'll get a lot of shooting pain
throughout the night, it'll wake me up. And I'm wondering, you've mentioned night splints. Is that something that would work for this kind of condition, or it wouldn't do any good, or what would you suggest? I also, the only thing I wear right now is these hikers that have, you know, I can lace up tight, and that keeps me from, that keeps me walking, but I need to wear some dress shoes.
Right.
Jill, what do you think?
Well, first of all, I just wanted to address the orthotics issue that she had mentioned, and she's a really good example of, it's important just to start with the off-the-shelf orthotics and see how people do with those, because many people can get by just fine that way. There's actually research that shows that people don't do any better in custom orthotics than off-the-shelf, and I'm sorry that Karen had it the reverse order, but many people do just fine with off-the-shelf orthotics, so thank you for bringing that up. Now I'm going to look at Lori, and she's going to answer the second part.
Oh, great. Sorry. Thanks. So there are a number of possible scenarios here. So the walking, repetitive walking in the bad shoes causes pain on the inside of your foot. Is that, do I have that right?
Yeah, that okay. seems to be the only thing, you know, that
okay.
happens.
Okay. So I'm glad you're seeing a physical therapist right. because hopefully the physical therapist will sort out the cause of the problem. It could be some tendinopathy.
Right.
The posterior tibialis tendon, which is directly related to foot mechanics and is very much associated with your plantar fascia and torque on your plantar fascia. If you were wearing bad shoes, you could have really developed a nasty tendinopathy there, and that will bother you at night when you're just laying there. You could also have put some sprain or some excessive tension on some of the ligaments on the inside of your foot. And if you have abnormal foot mechanics, which one might think you would because of your history of plantar fasciitis, you could also flare up some underlying arthritis in some of the joints around your ankle. So that would also cause night pain. So the key in any of those is going to be to correct the mechanics of your foot. And it's great that your off-the-shelf orthotics fixed your plantar fasciitis, but those orthotics may be worn out. You may need to replace those, and that could also be part of your problem.
There you go.
And the other thing might be, it's very difficult to get orthotics in dress shoes. She had mentioned dress shoes.
Yeah.
And there are a couple kind of low-profile orthotics or a taping technique that your physical therapist could show you so you could still be adequately supported in your dress shoes. Lori used to tape her feet with duct tape.
With duct tape.
When she would wear dress shoes, when she would lecture, when her plantar fascia was really bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it worked like a dream.
So there you go, Karen. Thank you very much for calling. Bill in Madison, your turn. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I'm going to walk through this real quickly, but I had, 5-6 years ago, I thought I got my plantar fasciitis from a jump off a small cliff, maybe only 5 feet above the sand, into the sand, and I thought it was a piece of glass in my heel.
Oh, yeah.
Finally went to, I have had a piece of glass in my foot before and pulled it out, but that wasn't what it was. My doc diagnosed it as plantar fasciitis, and I cured it myself very easily. Number one, I bought drugstore gel heels, and I've been wearing drugstore quality soles type gel soles ever since, but it's been long cured, and I cured it simply by stretching. Mm-hmm. Now, number one, you don't ever want to have your blankets at night touching your feet. You might even want a cardboard box to put your blankets over so your feet are in the cardboard box.
Mm-hmm.
And number two, stretching, 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 and more stretching. To the ways to stretch, let me focus on that because I'm convinced that's what cured mine. And some people may find this cure effective. You put your toes as far back toward your shin as you can to the count of 10, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, and you do about 3 reps of that every night in bed. You don't want to ever have anything on your feet at yeah. night in bed, like your blanket. You want to have that, kick it up loose off your feet.
Yeah.
That one.
Let's break in here for a sure. comment mm-hmm. from Jill.
Sure. Well, what Bill was referring to is not having your heavy blankets on your feet. If you lie on your back, what that weight does is it pushes your feet down into kind of a pointed position or plantar flexion. And so then your plantar fascia does get very, very tight. So what we were referring to with the use of a night splint, things like that, minimizes that. So that's just another way to avoid having your feet in that plantar flexion. And then Bill had mentioned how he stretched it by pulling his toes up towards his shin, and that with your, if you kind of pull your heel up and then pull your toes up towards your nose, that's a good way to stretch your plantar fasciitis.
Yeah,
plantar fascia.
Right, and if you only stretch your calf, you know, only stretch at your ankle and don't include the toes toward your shin, then you really miss the plantar fascia.
Right.
So pulling your toes back to your shin, as Bill suggested, is really the ticket to get the plantar fascia.
Yeah, so it's great yeah, advice.
There we go. Thank you, Bill. Appreciate the call. And we'll give Dave and New Holstein a chance. Hi, Dave.
Oh, hi. Thanks for putting on the show here today. It's wonderful. But I'm going to be hiking the Pacific Crest Trail in 2020.
Oh, good for you.
Oh, yeah. Thanks. But I a long time ago, 100 years ago, I was in the SEAL team, and we'd always start all our exercising by doing jumping jacks. And it feels really good. About 5 minutes after you do those, you're ready to go. But I'm getting older, and I'd like to do a stretch before the jumping jacks, and I'm just wondering what kind to do.
Well, that's a great question. So kind of the general rule of thumb we say is warm up to stretch, don't stretch to warm up. So the intent before you do some stretching is to get some good blood flow and circulation to your working muscles. So you're right. I would not start with jumping jacks as my first exercise out of the box. I would start with something that's lower impact, such as a nice brisk walk. Start with a slow walk or increase it to get the blood circulating, but not introducing that impact right away. Then I would go into stretching, and then if after you feel warmed up, your muscles are loose, then you could try some of the jumping jacks and things you had discussed.
Right, and in terms of walking, I would include not just forward walking, but
right.
backward walking, especially as we're talking about feet. It's going to work your feet the other direction and work some of the muscles on the backside, your hip extensors, your hamstrings, and so on. It's going to work them differently than walking forward. So some forward and backward walking would be great.
And good luck on your trip. Thanks
yeah,
a lot, Dave.
Sounds great.
Yeah, it sounds wonderful. Barb in Franklin, it's your turn. Hi, Barb.
Oh, hi there. Excuse me. This summer I had plantar fasciitis for almost 2 months with a very sore spot on my heel. And I went to, I'm a real Googler, I did read everything you could possibly read and did everything I could possibly do, and nothing seemed to help. And then I came across this one article by a serious hiker called Contrast Hydrotherapy,
yep,
where you start with something like 5 minutes of cold, 5 minutes of hot, 5 of cold, 5 of hot, and you end with 5 of cold. And it literally cured my plantar fasciitis in 2-3 days.
That's amazing.
I did it several times a day when I'm sitting there, and it was especially that sore spot. So, I mean, the article described how it helps, supposedly helps pull the fluid out of the swollen area and flush it away. And I just to mention it, it might not help everybody, but it sure helped me.
Well, thank you for that. That's a classic technique that we use anytime there's swelling in the ankle. It's typically used with people who have ankle sprains, who have a lot of swelling in their foot and ankle, and the heat increases the vasodilation, and then you put it in the cold, and it causes constriction. So the working hypothesis is, as you said, that it works to pump fluid out. It's not something we've typically used with plantar fasciitis, but it seems to have worked for you.
Yeah, exactly.
And thanks very much for calling. Ellen emailed to say she recently had a bout of vertigo. It's better now, but she still has occasional balance issues. Does physical therapy help with vertigo?
The question is absolutely yes. There are physical therapists who are trained in what we call vestibular rehabilitation, and they're trained very specifically in inner ear disturbances and balance disturbances related to that. So there's a couple very quick techniques that they can teach you how to self-treat. And even once your bout of vertigo is over, it's still really important to make sure that you have good balance. So yes, most healthcare systems, large healthcare systems, will have a physical therapist that can treat a vestibular disorder such as vertigo.
And what do those exercises look like?
Well, they're kind of somersaultish, for lack of better terms. But if you actually knock the fluid in your semicircular canals in your ears kind of off balance, you have to position your head in three different directions. So I call it a somersault technique. It's the Epley maneuver is what it's called.
Right. So your inner ear, which tells you where your balance is an oriented in three different planes. You have these three canals that are oriented three different ways. And so you basically are resetting those by moving the fluid in each of those canals. So you have to move your head in three different planes.
Right.
Very interesting. Yes. Well, I'll tell you what, our two guests are going to be with us right up till 12:30 today. Lori Tyne Brody, physical therapist and athletic trainer at UW's Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, an associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy programs. And you'll be able to join in. Number's 800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. Back with our guests right after this look at the news. You stay with us. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at all kinds of physical therapy issues today, but zeroing in a lot, actually, on plantar fasciitis. Lori Tyne Brody, physical therapist, athletic trainer at the UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. One of our guests, the other, Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program. One open line for you at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And let's go right back to the phones and to Stanley in Rhinelander. Stanley, hi. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm 85 years old, and I've suffered for about 40 years from most of the ailments that you talked about and many more. However, over the last 10 years, I had very little pain until 2 weeks ago. But for about 40 years, I suffered with back pain, all kinds of cramps, whatever, and chiropractors helped me through almost all of it. I was even referred to a spinal surgeon at one time. But the one contributing factor that I found did the most harm was a chronic lack of hydration.
Oh.
And since I have become aware of that, I have virtually no pain, no back pain, no joint pain. I only take one prescription, and that's finasteride.
But that is an issue. Hydration is an issue, and Stanley's getting up there a little bit. He's older,
right.
And
right. Well, as we age, our tissues lose fluid, and so much of our body is made up of water that keeping everything adequately hydrated is really important.
Yeah, and I know that as you get older, many times people don't like to drink a lot because they don't want to have to get up during the night and use the restroom.
Especially if you have plantar fasciitis,
that's right. But, if you drink a lot, they think, what wakes me up? I'm not getting enough, good sleep because I have to get up and use the restroom all the time. So I'm not going to drink so much. So think about the timing of your fluid intake, mm-hmm. First thing in the morning and drinking more through the first half of the day, more than you might think you need, because you do need that fluid, as Stanley has said, and you don't want to get up during the night frequently and to use the restroom, because it does disrupt your deep sleep. So you really have to focus on having a little bit extra, and then make sure you speak with your doctor or your pharmacist pharmacist if you're taking any medication and whether a lot of fluid will impact any of your medications as well.
And what about coffee as part of the fluid?
Well, that's as I sit here with my giant cup today.
But you also have a giant bottle of water sitting next to it.
Indeed, indeed. So the, you know, historically, people have thought of coffee as a diuretic, and it may be a bit of a diuretic, but for people who are chronic coffee drinkers, it does actually add fluid. It is not a diuretic in that you lose more fluid than you take in when you drink coffee, but it does work on the plus side of the equation as adequate fluid intake or as a fluid intake.
We turn next to Annette in Beaver Dam. Hi, Annette.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was diagnosed about 5 years ago with Morton's neuropathy.
Okay.
Okay.
And my general practitioner, he did put a shot in there, which didn't help. And then he sent me to a neurologist, and he gave me no help whatsoever. I was wondering if there's any new things out to help with that.
Sure. Well, typically a Morton's neuroma or Morton's neuropathy happens between your third and fourth or fourth and fifth toes. And what it is it's a kind of a bundle of nerves that is laid down with some scar tissue, and it becomes quite painful in kind of your push-off phase of walking, and that pain goes into your toes. Many times we see it in people who wear shoes that have too tight of a toe box.
Cowboy boots.
There you go. Or pumps, mm-hmm. like stiletto heels, something like that. And the other cohort we see it in a fair amount is people who use like a Stairmaster, an elliptical for exercise, and they spend a good deal of time up on their toes instead of letting their heel drop all the time. So treatment for it is typically making sure that you have adequate mobility in your foot, that there isn't any area of your foot that is too stiff or causing the entrapment. And then we usually make recommendations regarding shoe wear for a shoe with a wider toe box.
Yeah, so seeing a physical therapist, if you haven't seen one, would probably be good advice, particularly if you're having symptoms in one foot and not the other, because the question is, why are you having problems in one foot? And they may be able to detect some asymmetry side to side that are contributing to this and give you some activities that may help relieve your symptoms. And I just wanted to address the neurologist. My guess is that your physician wanted to make sure that there wasn't some sort of systemic neurologic thing going on. And so although the neurologist didn't help your Morton's neuroma, you were cleared.
Probably ruled out
any other underlying neurologic disease. And so now we know that's the good news. What you have is a Morton's neuroma. So let's deal with that from a foot perspective.
Annette, thank you so much for calling. Let's turn to Sharon in Stevens Point. Hi, Sharon.
Hello, thank you for taking my call, and thank you for this program. I have had plantar fasciitis for 4 years now. I've been through around the block through everything. I've had physical therapy. I've had cortisone injections. Of course, I'm wearing all different kinds of orthotics. I actually had a dry needling procedure done that was ineffective. Finally, I had surgery just about a year ago now, and wore a boot for a month after that surgery. That was just on one foot. I do have the fasciitis in both feet. So I guess my question is, are there some cases that are just chronic and you will not get over this?
I definitely think there are cases that become chronic. And then the very challenging thing with somebody who has a chronic condition like this, as you had mentioned so well, is to find the cause. So you had tried numerous interventions, but there are people who certainly, even if we can identify the cause, whether it's excessive walking, things like that, we can't alleviate it. And the classic thing that comes to mind for me is the letter carrier,
mm-hmm. right?
Who has to walk all day long, uneven terrain, different terrains, has to wear, you know, kind of stiff shoes, and is carrying an excessive load.
Up and down steps.
Up and down mm-hmm. steps. And so mm-hmm. that is one of those people that may suffer from chronic plantar fasciitis because we can't get rid of the cause, in mm-hmm. essence.
Yeah, yeah. So yes, we know I see people who have chronic plantar fasciitis, and it tends to come and go.
Right.
Sometimes it's better, sometimes it's a little bit worse, and we do our best to manage it, but it doesn't ever really completely go away. And one of the keys is you have to figure out if there are any triggers, a certain shoe wear, standing, the kind of surface that you're standing or walking on. Body weight is an issue.
Right.
And as we said at the top of the show, nutrition comes into play as well. So when you have a problem that has so many potential contributing factors and so many variables, it gets really hard to sort through what are the real triggers. So sometimes it's helpful for people to keep a little bit of a log or a diary, and when they look back on it, they can see a pattern. So that might be something to help you sort out what triggers the worsening of your symptoms.
Thanks for calling, Sharon. Appreciate it. And let's go to Michelle in Madison. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. So I'm calling today because my 10-year-old son, about 3 weeks ago, was diagnosed with something called Sever's disease.
Sievers disease.
Sievers, thank you.
That's
for
okay.
The pronunciation correction. By his pediatrician, he's a sports kiddo, so he's playing soccer, and he's also playing basketball in the winter. So she recommended ice 3 times a day for about 15, 20 minutes, and then she gave him some heel inserts.
Yep.
And he's progressively gotten better, which we've been very happy about. But I'm concerned about keeping it that way so he can continue to enjoy his sports.
Right.
And I've seen some videos online about taping, or was considering setting up a PT appointment for him to see if there's some things we could do to maybe keep it where it is now, or, you know, prevent it from getting any worse.
Sure.
Yep.
And what is Sievers disease, by the way?
Sievers disease is the heel version of Osgood-Schlatter's. People have heard of Osgood-Schlatter's at your knee. It is an apophysitis. It is an inflammation where the tendon attaches to the bone when your growth plates are open. So at the knee, people get it where you see that bump on the front of their knee on their tibia. Some people, you'll see, I have a patient that has the biggest tibial tubercle I have ever seen.
Really?
Because he had chronic Osgood-Schlatter.
So what happens is when you tug, when the tendons
muscle.
Tug, the muscle tugs at this bony insertion, it tells your body to lay down more bone.
Right. So at your heel, you may lay down a little bit more bone, which is why you want to keep this in check, because you don't want a big bony prominence on the back of your heel. It will rub and annoy you for the rest of your life. All of my boys have had this at one point or another, and they're soccer players. So see a physical therapist to see if there's any other suggestions. You know, stretching in the right dosage so it doesn't aggravate the Sievers is the right call. Looking at his foot mechanics to see if there's something there that needs to be altered. A little bit of focused strengthening can help. And I assume he's wearing the inserts in both of his shoes?
Yes, he's wearing it in his regular tennis shoes, his soccer shoes, and we were going to have him, basketball's going to start in probably 3 weeks, so we're going to do the same.
Right. And there are specific soccer inserts that you can get. You can wear the heel lifts if they're uncomfortable. There is a local person who makes soccer-specific inserts to fit in soccer shoes, which are a little bit different than other shoes. The key for him is he's got to keep up with the exercises and icing. So whatever strategies you as a parent have, whether he's stretching his calves while he brushes his teeth, twice a day, or every time he goes up and down the stairs, he stops and stretches for a few seconds, but incorporating the activities into what he already does during the day, then making sure he's icing, like you don't get to play Fortnite unless you're icing your heels at the same time.
Sounds like you have experience with this, Lori.
Exactly. So yes, you are absolutely right. You're going to need to keep it in check.
Good luck, Michelle. Thank you again for calling. Robert in Fayetteville, Arkansas, will turn to you next. Hi, Robert.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. I've had numbness in my left arm, and especially the left pinky of the left hand. And this began about earlier in the year, the very beginning, perhaps, was an accident that was about a year ago, a car accident. And the airbags had bruised my right arm, and I thought it was just a bruise that I was getting over. But subsequently, I began to have, early in this year, pains all over that were diagnosed as PMR. And I got prednisone for that. And the pains went away. And then about middle of this year, this numbness in the left arm, and especially, as I say, the left hand, which is extremely numb with the pinky. So apparently a nerve on the left side of my left arm is somehow...
is a problem. What can... any help here?
So I assume that you've been seeing somebody for all these problems?
Yes, I have been going, again, the diagnosis of the PMR and a high dosage of prednisone, which I've been taking regularly, or, you know, as prescribed.
Sure. And has someone examined your neck in terms of this numbness in your left arm? Because that PMR is polymyalgia rheumatica. It's an autoimmune disease. So that shouldn't cause any symptoms in your left arm. So has someone examined your neck?
I haven't had an examination since then regarding the neck.
Okay, so that would be my very next step. So if you have numbness in your hand, particularly if the numbness is constant, if it doesn't come and go, you need that examined. So you're getting pressure on a nerve somewhere. It could be coming at your wrist. It could be coming at your elbow. It could be coming from your neck. And you won't know that unless someone does an examination.
Right.
So my next step would be probably seeing my physician and telling him or her about these symptoms in your arm. And you need your neck examined.
Right. I agree.
Yeah. Good luck.
That's a good place to start.
Robert, thank you so much. And good luck to you. We have Dennis in Madison next. Hi, Dennis.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
I was wondering, I have trigger finger in both hands.
Mm-hmm.
I tried acupuncture, and then on the 29th of August, I just had the surgery for my ring finger and my middle finger on my right hand. But my left hand, I'm wondering if there's something besides surgery that fixes that.
Did you have any corticosteroid injections?
Yes.
And they didn't
work?
Three
on each.
Three on each. And what's your, are you having a good outcome on your right hand? With the surgery?
No, because I think I have some other issues with a couple fingers, so they're like some arthritis and stuff, so.
Okay.
I mean, it's a lot, it doesn't lock anymore, but the healing process doesn't seem to be that good.
Okay. All right. Have you seen an occupational therapist at all for this, or a certified hand therapist?
No, they never suggested that at all. I didn't think it was an option.
I think that would be a great place to start, especially if you have an interest in managing this conservatively. You have it in both hands, which is significant. And it sounds like your surgical outcome isn't quite what you expected in your surgical hand. So I would contact your physician and request a referral to see an occupational therapist or a certified hand therapist, which can be either a PT or an OT. And yes, in Madison, there's lots of people who are here who could help you.
Yeah, we have a hand clinic at UW.
So good luck on that, Dennison. Just stay listening here. Marion Madison had a trigger finger on her middle finger diagnosed. She's taking ibuprofen, a splint on that finger. Mm-hmm. She finds that holding a hot beverage in a cup helps the ache in her hand. Would adding a heat-cold regimen help, she's wondering?
It could. You know, usually we go to a heat-cold regimen where there's noticeable swelling, or we really want to kind of flush the system. So With somebody with a trigger finger, it's usually, there's usually not that much swelling involved, but it's usually just the stiffness that comes with
it. Yeah, sometimes heat cold is nice in the summer.
Right.
But the fact that it feels so much better in terms of her ache with the warmth, my guess is the cold is going to increase the
correct
ache for her.
I agree.
Would diet help the reduce the inflammation, Mary wonders?
Sure. I mean, anytime you can take any inflammatory components out of your diet, you should.
Well, interestingly, she said she's taking ibuprofen, so my guess is the ibuprofen is helping or she wouldn't be taking it, and it's an anti-inflammatory, so that would suggest that inflammation is part of the puzzle for her. So switching to an anti-inflammatory diet certainly could help. It's not going to be immediate. It will take time, but okay. I would say that's generally good for anyone.
Correct.
Elroy in Loyal, do you have a question for us?
I do. Good afternoon, ladies and Larry. I tore my collateral ligaments in my left index finger about 6 months ago, and I was a little hesitant to have surgery done on it. So for about the last 6 weeks, I've just been buddy strapping that finger to my middle finger, but only at night while I sleep. It's just not possible for me to do that during the daytime on my job. Wondering if I have any other options other than surgery or what I'm currently doing.
So do you have a boutonniere deformity or a swan neck deformity? Has anybody used those words with you?
No.
Okay. So it'd be worth seeing somebody, because when you do damage those collateral ligaments, then what happens is other tendons can overpower it, and you can basically end up with a long-term deformity, either called a swan neck or a boutonniere, depending on which tendons take over. So it would be worth seeing somebody for that, and you too could be seeing an occupational therapist for this. There's some really nice low profile splints that you can wear that will kind of minimize the deformity and still keep your hand quite functional. So it may be a couple exercises from an OT and then a splint recommendation for you.
Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Back to plantar fasciitis for a minute. Jim from Wausau called to say that biking was the only thing that helped his plantar fasciitis.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's nice. It's non-impact, and so, but it's still good blood flow and circulation to your lower extremities.
Right, and it may be getting a little bit of pressure on your plantar fascia, and it may be getting a little bit of repetitive stretching as you go around in the cycle. And particularly if he switched from a weight-bearing activity. So I don't know if he was doing nothing and then bicycled and it helped, but if he had been doing something like an elliptical or walking or running where he was weight-bearing and switched to a non-weight-bearing activity, that could have been as much as anything in terms of help.
Right.
And, boy, here we are about out of time. Quickly here, Roy in Racine is 70, several months beyond successful cancer treatment, has neuropathy in his toes. Anything there that might help?
Well, I would suggest seeing a physical therapist, and I see many people in the pool who need reconditioning, particularly after cancer therapy, and they have various joint pains or neuropathy or whatever, and we get them moving in a pool with some unweighting but some resistance of the water.
Always a pleasure, you two. Thank you so much. You're back on November 19th, and we'll do
That's
this
great.
All over again. Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. Lori, physical therapist, athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Jill, an associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program. They'll be back on the 19th of November. Tomorrow at 11, we'll talk about eating disorders, and then Mike Beano from our Wisconsin Magazine joins us. Thanks for listening. Please stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.